Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, March 10th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everybody. It is 59 degrees, raining and very dark and dank here in upstate New York. But wow, does it feel like spring? It actually was hot out here in the office this morning, and it feels like I might have to get that air conditioner out already to throw into the window to keep these servers cool, because a fan just isn't cutting it. And we would hate to have servers start going because they got too hot. So where do we leave off yesterday? Well, 3 minutes before the show, everything on not one, not two, but three computers stopped working. So we're going to find out here in a second if anything loads. We titled the show Google, DARPA, Body on a Chip, and Nadine the Companion Robot. And we did. We talked about Nadine, and we actually might get there today, though I don't know how much we're going to be able to do if nothing loads. Hey, look, here's a window after waiting for 6 minutes. Yeah, we looked at a whole bunch of things yesterday, actually. Let's continue on. If we can get Nadine to load, we can talk about her. Or maybe not. We'll find out. Oh, look, and that's not even the Nadine story anymore. Well, let's find out. Hold on. Nadine. Should I start humming? Oh, look at the tabs all spinning just out of the blue. Even though I didn't want to load you and everything was loaded, it just spins and gives me a white page now. I have no stories. I'm staring at a blank page. And I really have nothing in my brain because it has been a horrible week. I had to take a Benadryl yesterday because of major allergies. Oh, look. Holy shit. All right. Oh, so now a page comes up, but it doesn't scroll. And it only comes up with half a page. Like it can't load. And oh, all this memory on my system is being sucked dry from some unknown source. What the fuck? This is unbelievable. You know what, guys? I really think they want me just to stop doing a show. And that means I could sleep in the morning. All right, Nadine. Meet Nadine, the emotionally intelligent companion robot. So I'm going to highly doubt that Skype will ever connect to this machine. Hate to tell you, but I think that's going to be the case. Especially if everything is, like, so kludgy right now. Nadine, the emotionally intelligent companion robot. What will robots look like in the future? Will they retain obvious signs of their artificial nature, or will they seemingly blend in with people to such an extent that we might have difficulty telling them apart from living, breathing humans? You know, we talked about that last week, about how the more anthropomorphic robots look, the less people are going to open their arms and accept them, which I think surprised researchers because they have been trying for the longest time to make androids that look quite human, and now they're finding out that people get creeped out the more human these creatures look. They would be happier with something that looked like a Jibo, I would assume, than something that looked like a Nadine, which, gotta tell you, I mean, though she looks a little goofy trying to speak with her mouth, blah, 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 you know, I mean, it's not really forming proper, whatever they call it, where the lips form around the words, but she sure can converse. Anyway, if Nadine, a new socially and emotionally intelligent robot from scientists in Singapore, is a sign of things to come, realistic-looking humanoid machines might just have the edge over artificially, obviously artificial counterparts. And I'm going to say that in sex bots is probably where it's going to be. I don't think many people are going to want a Nadine bot in their house with those creepy-looking dead eyes. How come? Well, because a physical resemblance to ordinary people could help us interact with the machine. And that's what the scientists have been saying. But like I said, that is not what their research has been showing. Because a physical resemblance to ordinary people could help us interact with the machine in a more natural way. Whether at home, at work, or if it were to look after us when we get old. And I actually have a story on an R2-D2 take care of you when you get old robot, if I can ever get there. Over the past 4 years, our team at Nanyang University have been fostering cross-disciplinary research in social robotic technologies, says Nadia Thalman, to transform a virtual human from within a computer into a physical being that is able to observe and interact with other humans. How frightening does that sound? By employing linguistics and psychology in addition to conventional robotics fields such as engineering and computer science, researchers have sought to blur the distinction between human and machine. Nadine, which is designed to look like a physical doppelganger of a young Thalman, that's this Nadia Thalman that is working with this robot, but it is supposed to help us relate to her as if the robot were just an ordinary person. This is somewhat like a real companion that is always with you and conscious of what is happening.
Meet Nadine, a lifelike robot with personality to match.
I am a social companion. I can speak of emotions and I can recognize people.
Developed by a research team at Singapore's Nanyang Technological University, Nadine can even recall previous conversations.
Where are you born?
Nadia Thalman, NTU's Director of Institute for Media Innovation, says Nadine's intelligent behavior is almost indistinguishable from that of a human.
She's truly like a companion, you know. It's like a beautiful sculpture, if you look. But she has life and she can interact with you. So for me, the Turing test is from long, she has passed the Turing test since a long time. Yeah.
Nadine is modeled after Thalman, and her standout feature is her emotional intelligence. Her vocabulary and knowledge expand the more she interacts with people, and Nadine autonomously chooses what to say, making dialogue with every person different.
You are horrible.
Nor are you.
I don't like you.
I don't like to talk with you.
Okay, goodbye.
Stop talking to me anymore.
Researchers say her ability to interact makes her an ideal companion for those suffering from dementia or autism.
If you leave these people alone, they will be going down very quickly. So these people need to be always in interaction. So Nadine is typically a robot that could stay when there is nobody else to read stories, to maintain conversation, to try to make some simple games with color or whatever.
The team is working on developing her hands as well as her voice and movements. Nadine's happy to help them improve her.
I think we can figure this out together.
And, you know, here's something I was thinking about, too. Making these realistic-looking robots and being able to pattern them after humans, especially individuals. I mean, we've seen a few of them. There was the one that was made to look like the sci-fi writer Philip K. Dick that was pretty intelligent and able to converse to some capacity, not quite like Nadine, though. If I could play the video, you'd see. But Philip K. Dick, and then there was the Japanese scientist who also made a doppelganger of himself, of an android. You know, we were reading about uploading and downloading consciousness and some of the things that Google is working on, and downloading robotic personalities and things for the future as part of an app store. You know, it makes one wonder if this isn't just another part of that whole 2045 project. You know, like I said, we could download Nana for Christmas dinner. If we had like a Nana doppelganger android that we kept in the crawl space and pulled out during holidays and then downloaded her personality, you know, we downloaded her updates at Christmas. so she could give Christmas stories of things that she remembers. I don't know. This just, to me, I start to have future flashes, like just quick, like snapshots in my head when I start reading stuff like this about what things are going to be like. And guys, I don't even know what to tell you, but kill all robots. These are not good things. You know, I saw Google's AI. They now have this, we talked last week or the week before. Not only is Google's DeepMind project won against the global chess champion, but then it beat the global Go champion. And, you know, that was really the first time I had heard of Go. Talking to my kid about it because she loves chess, and she's like, oh, let's see if we can find it online. Let's see if we can find a game. I want to play it. So I went digging around just on my cell phone in the app store, and I found a Go app. I downloaded it myself and started trying to play it, figuring how hard could this be. You know, eventually I'm sure I'll figure it out. It was extremely complicated, so I started reading about it on Wiki, and it apparently is one of the most complex, if not the most complex, difficult games that there is. Well, I saw this morning that Google is having a Go championship now, again, against its AI DeepMind from March 8th through the 15th, and their AI beat the world champion again. Guys, we've just crossed a threshold. Remember we were talking about the Turing? I don't know if this is what they actually term as Turing, by beating them in a game, because that actually was kind of like the singularity type timeline there. The Turing was being able to tell a humanoid from a human, like, let's say, a customer service agent on the phone. People still accuse, and probably more frequently now, some of the call center AI that's being used and trying to decide whether or not it's a real person, because it's very tough to tell at times. They aren't robotic voices anymore, and they actually have intelligent responses that they can give. Anyway, let's get back to Nadine. And maybe what I'll do is I'll cut out all my bitching for the afternoon show, and I'll cut Nadine's video clip in there so you guys can hear her, because it is kind of creepy. This is what a real companion that is always with you and conscious of what is happening, says Thalman. So in the future, these socially intelligent robots could be like C-3PO with knowledge of language and etiquette. Yeah, but it doesn't look like C-3PO. Like, I would be all right, I think, with a robot that actually looked like C-3PO, and probably most of Generation X would be. And maybe even Y and Z, because we all grew up with Star Wars and those happy little robots. And it's interesting that she mentions C-3PO in this other story. Then we have this healthcare robot that looks a lot like R2-D2. But when they start looking human and they have that obvious dead look in their eyes, she moves her head and her hands and she's on a keyboard. It's really creepy looking. It starts to make me feel like I'm in a dystopian film at that point. Anyway, so here we go, and this is like the kickoff to these being sex bots, I'm telling you, because listen to this description. With soft skin and fairly convincing-looking hair, Nadine is a pretty eerie emulation of an actual person, especially when the face is moving, as you can see in the video above, and yeah, that'll be the one I cut in later. Of course, those vacant eyes could use a little work. Yeah, that's what I said, her eyes look creepier than shit, and the robot's static, empty look in between actions gives away that it is not a real person. Still, these are the kinds of things that the researchers are working on, and if some of Nadine's obvious tells can be eroded, it is possible that people interacting with the robot would be more at ease rather than less. And Kismet was one of the original robots that they had been working with, and it was at MIT, maybe, or Harvard, but I almost think it was MIT, where they were working on Kismet. Kismet was an early, emotionally responsive robot, and in the beginning, they didn't even have any skin on it. It was just all metallic parts and moving gears and things, levers. But the one thing that Kismet did have was a mouth and eyes. And Kismet was designed specifically to mimic facial expressions. And it was the very early steps, like I was talking about, when they were first trying to develop the best form for bipedal robots, and they determined after many failures that a stature such as an ostrich or an emu with the two back legs and the way that they're positioned was the most stable. Kismet was also one of those very, very early designs where they were doing social experiments, psychological experiments on participants interacting with the robot to see what kind of a different response they would get when the robots actually reacted with facial expressions. Because, you know, that's one of the issues with, like, email or texting. And something that's huge in the animal kingdom, it's not just what you say, but you also have the intonation of your voice. You also have your facial and your bodily expressions that all then warp what you're trying to say. And I'm one of those people that my face tends to give me away every single time. I got to practice on my poker face. But when I'm saying something, you know, kind of like the Ted Cruz dilemma. No, I'm not comparing myself to Ted Cruz, but something about Ted Cruz. And I was reading a couple different psychological breakdowns as to why people have a dislike for Cruz. And I mean, there's many reasons. Number one being that he's a war hawk. I don't know. He seems so fake to me. But one of the reasons why they're saying, and I totally see this when I watch him, and especially if you turn the volume off and you just watch him, is he says one thing, but his facial expressions are saying something else. And you always see that the corners of his mouth is downturned, and he's got this, like, look in his eye. I don't know. I just don't trust the guy, because you know he's thinking something else other than what he's saying, and he's just parroting what's out there. And it's very hard for me. I tend to go out of my way to be as honest as possible at all times, even if, and I don't know, I mean, maybe I would have to say that sometimes I'm not as honest if I know it's going to hurt somebody's feelings. I try to soft touch it. But, I mean, if there's something that's especially, that I'm especially vocal about, I don't hold back. But see, that makes you a more genuine person. And, you know, when people lie, that's where the quote-unquote tell comes from. Everybody has a tell. And in a lot of this behavioral technology that they're working on now, especially with the cameras and that, that's something that they're looking at. Like, when you're not telling the truth, you typically will glance away for a second instead of looking somebody in the eyes, or you'll rub your neck or rub your hands together, and it'll give you away every single time. So anyway, all I'm saying is they've done a lot of work on the psychological responses to other individuals to get to this point now. And so Nadine, I don't think right now, just like Atlas, where Atlas is big and clunky and in the DARPA challenge to make you think that they weren't that far along, I'm going to tell you that in a lab somewhere, they probably have a very emotionally responsive robot that does pretty well with facial expressions. Actually, I remember seeing a video one time where they had like 300 little sensors in the face for all the different muscle groups in the face to be able to do micro movements. So I don't think it's going to be too long before we see something that looks very, very realistic and can interact with you just as if it were a real person. Anyway, let's continue here. Anyway, so they talk about her empty look. Still, these are the kinds of things that researchers are working on, and if some of Nadine's obvious tells can be eroded, so they do mention the tells, it is possible that people interacting with the robot would be more at ease rather than less, and especially when it's programmed with a sense of personality and emotions, with quotation marks. It is designed to remember you and the details of your previous conversations. Now, how creepy is that? It'll remember you. Hey, Clyde, how you doing? How's that sick cat you got there? Nadine currently acts in the role of a receptionist at Nanyang Technological University a calling we've seen other somewhat more conspicuous robots fulfill. But according to researchers, this kind of technology could make the most sense as domestic companions in the home. Ding, ding, ding. And then, of course, they clarify that, especially for those who need help caring for themselves. So it's not for the sex bots. No. Domestic companion, we mean like taking care of Nana. That's what we mean. I'm sure they're seeing dollar signs. As countries worldwide face challenges of an aging population, social robots can be one solution to address the shrinking workforce. Yeah, the shrinking workforce where all of our jobs, 50% of the jobs are going to be taken in the next 10 years. They can also become personal companions for children. Like I said before, there's not a robot in this world that is going to get their hands on my child as a babysitter, or for the elderly at home, and even serve as a platform for healthcare services in the future. So doctors, look out. You're helping them fuel this revolution of high-tech medicine. But soon we're going to have high-tech robotic doctors. And if you've seen the TV show Humans, you'll have an idea of what the system could look like. It might be a while before robots like Nadine are as convincing as human synths. But that day definitely looks like it is getting closer. So before I continue,
could you be replaced in your office by a robot? Or might your partner become less interested in you and more interested in a sex robot? According to computer scientist Moshe Vardy, perhaps. At least he says we shouldn't underestimate the potential of artificial intelligence. He told the American Association for the Advancement of Science over the weekend, "I believe that society needs to confront this question before it is upon us. If machines are capable of doing almost any work humans can do, what will humans do?" To talk about some of these questions, I spoke earlier with legal and media analyst Lionel of Lionel Media.
I don't necessarily fear the superiority, because you will never be able to be superior to human sentience and human aspects and our, by definition, humanity. But what scares me is that we're not talking about robots. People confuse the two. People are thinking about an assembly line where a factory worker might be replaced by some robotic. We're talking about the roboticization of human interaction, and specifically human interaction with war. A artificial intelligence situation that, for example, defines its own algorithm. And Anya, understand something. The first thing that an AI unit will want to do is to program you, is to figure out your sensibilities. And you know, whenever we talk about this, people laugh about sex robots. It's part of our infantilized world of sex, but also the way we look at the impact of this. If we continue, or if my dystopic future comes to pass, we're going to little by little separate ourselves. We're going to replace human interaction, human connectivity, human relations with that of virtual reality, a robot, Lars and the real girl. Mm. It's going to come to fruition. And with that comes basically the end of civilization and humanity as we know it.
Well, that's so dark, Lionel. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, you talked about war, so my first thought is, well, we already seem to be partially there with the drone war, where the president can have a kill list and we don't need boots on the ground. We can send out a machine, though there's still a human being, I guess, behind it to some degree. How can we stop this from getting any further then if that the outlook is so dark, as you've outlined?
The first thing we have to do is we have to stop and we have to become an adult about this. That may be a taller order than anybody can imagine. We need somebody to listen to Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and others who are saying, wait a minute, let me repeat. Maybe if we could just distill it into one little bumper sticker, one phrase. Robots are one thing. Artificial intelligence is another. A robot is great. It gets rid of the drudgery. Little robot that vacuums your apartment. That's wonderful. I'm not talking about that. That's not what I'm getting at. I'm talking about something that replaces human sentience, human morals, human, maybe we shouldn't do this, judgment, things that are prototypically and actually human. And I'm saying it again, when you introduce an algorithm, I mean, imagine the worst virus in the world, the worst Trojan horse, something that gets into our military system and takes over. And then one day, when somebody's pushing the button to recall that drone strike, to recall that battalion of Hellfire missile launchers, and you push and it says, uh-uh, we've taken over. This is Asimov. This is iRobot. We've been talking about this since the beginning of time. And unfortunately, I fear it's going to come to fruition unless we do something now. And the first thing we need to do is stop thinking that it's cool and use our heads and grow up.
We should also note that anything that requires an algorithm usually requires more surveillance and data collection as well. So that was Emmy Award-winning legal and media analyst Lionel of Lionel Media. Thank you so much.
R2-D2's next assignment as hospital orderly. Meet Tugs. Tugs, he's so cute. A team of 27 robots now zooming around the hallways of a new University of California San Francisco hospital at Mission Bay. They look a bit like R2-D2 dragging a platform around behind them instead of drones. Think of them more as little flatbed trucks ferrying carts of stuff around a vast hospital complex. Food, linens, medication, medical waste, and garbage. And they do it much more efficiently than humans. Hey, guess what? Now we can replace all the hospital orderlies. Hey, this is going up one of the floors. It's carrying meals that were ordered. All right. In probably the last 20 minutes, says Dan Hironoid, who is in charge of this elite fleet, as he pointed to a robot monitoring by him. Henroyd, who is also the director of nutrition and food services for the hospital, says that each tug travels about 35 miles a day, and over the past year, they have made more than 157,000 trips throughout the hospital. Henroyd says that no one in the hospital has lost a job due to the robots. Well, phew. Notice how they get to point that out. University of California, San Francisco was in the midst of a hiring spree for the new hospital, and the tugs allowed him to hire about 30 fewer workers than he would have otherwise. But hey, nobody lost their job. We just had 30 jobs that we displaced, is what they basically just said. He added that the robots are really just carting things from one point to another, something most humans would not find particularly rewarding. No, they wouldn't find it rewarding. But you know what? It provides a paycheck. The tug has a job to do, and it is sort of a thankless job, so I think better to have a robot doing it, perhaps, than a human. Yeah, let's justify that. But not everyone in the hospital is such a big fan of the tugs. I think they're helpful, but I think they're also kind of a pain, says Marty Thompson, a nurse in the neonatal intensive care unit. I've seen them run into computers. I've seen them run into glass doors. I've seen them run into each other, and sometimes, she says, two tugs get stuck near the nurse's station, each one waiting for the other to pass, and the nurses call that a tug of war. She says, over the past year, the robots have gotten better, but for Thompson, there is still the issue of jobs. And definitely there are jobs lost, which is kind of interesting to me, because with the economy the way it is, you would think that people need jobs. No kidding. And we now have robots doing them, says Thompson. Overall, the tug program has cost the university about $6 million, including the changes required to the hospital infrastructure to accommodate them. But Henright says that it still saved the hospital money. Well, of course, you know, think about it. No pensions, no sick time, no vacation time, no paycheck. That $6 million is going to pay itself off pretty quickly, especially when you have an army of 35 of these. The cost of transporting materials and supply waste is an overhead cost. So the more you can do that efficiently, the less cost you have, he explained. And now let's multiply that by 120 hospitals throughout the U.S. who are using tugs, according to the manufacturer Atheon in Pittsburgh. And for some departments, such as the bustling hospital kitchen where Tug picks up carts loaded with trays of food and drops off dirty dishes, employees have eagerly adopted their automated coworkers. In nutrition food services, we have named all of ours for fruit. So we have apple, pear, berry, orange, and grape. You know, again, this is more of that psychology on how to accept new technologies, make them pretty colors, or give them silly names, and people are more apt to open their arms and accept them. If they were called, like, Synthroid 1, I'm sure that people wouldn't be as hunky-dory over these things. Oh, look, there's Blueberry going to get the trays. The tugs are kind of cute, yes, but also a little unnerving as they shuffle past other hospital workers like they own the joint. And each one is carefully programmed to stay out of the way, says Henroyd. But sometimes it feels as if one could be mowed down by a bystander. No, sometimes it feels as if one could mow down a bystander. In a moment of bravery, a visitor decided to step in Tug's path. It headed straight for her, but it stopped suddenly a safe distance away. Henroyd seems pleased. You have faith, he says. See, it stopped 2 feet away from you. You thought it was going to run into you. Ha, ha, ha. The tugs have sensors along their base that can tell if anything is in their way. And these little robots have very little contact with patients. They mostly stay in the hallway or in the nurses' stations where human workers pick up their goods and deliver them to patients in person. When the kids in the children's hospital catch a glance, however, it is quite a scene. Medical surgical unit coordinator Michael Eckenrode pointed out that a dozen plastic toy vehicles nearby, including a cab and a bike, and the children like to climb aboard and ride them around the unit. And when the robots come, the kids start screaming, "Robots!" and they follow them down the hall. And it goes down around the corner, opens the elevator, and gets on all by itself, so it's like magic for the children. Rogelio Diaz Ramirez, an adorable 3-year-old, was in the hospital with a lung infection, and he could not stop smiling at just the thought of seeing a robot for the very first time. Yeah, those kids, I'm telling you, the kids are doomed because the kids see robots. We've been inundated and brainwashed through movies over the last 3 generations now about our robotic companions. You know, like I talked about before, WALL-E. Disney movie, WALL-E was supposed to be, you know, the good, happy-feeling robot that saved the planet Earth and all of humanity. These kids aren't going to see anything wrong with us at all. We are going to search for a robot, says nurse Sonia Salinas in Spanish as she took Rogelio's hand and led him through the hall. Salinas spotted Tug coming around the corner. "Robot, come on, run, run," she told the little boy. And when he caught up, Rogelio looked awestruck, and Selena showed him how to press the big green and red buttons on top that make Tug go and stop. Until it's time for the Tug to attend its next assignment. "Say goodbye. Goodbye, Tuggy," she told him. "Adios," said the little boy. So there you go. I mean, it is really moving faster. 120 hospitals already that they have moved into. And that is just the beginning. We had another story yesterday. IBM and Hilton Hotels have joined in a partnership again. If we can get this story to load, or maybe if I can copy this URL. The partnership between IBM, Hilton and IBM. And what's IBM's good old artificial intelligence, but good old Watson. It's trying. It's trying. I see the headline at the very bottom of the page. It's coming. Hilton and IBM build a Watson-powered concierge robot named Connie after Conrad Hilton. And we've seen these little Connie robots before. Pigmine had a few videos, and I believe that they were in Japan at one of the consumer electronics shows, where there were probably 30 or 40 of these all dancing in, like, synchronized dance patterns on the stage. It's the same little mini robot that stands on the counter and talks to you. Hilton is testing an artificially intelligent powered concierge robot for its chain of hotels in the U.S. through a partnership with the IBM Watson program. The automation called Connie, after the company's founder, Conrad Hilton, can already be found in the Hilton McLean Hotel in Virginia, and guests can ask it questions about nearby restaurants, tourist attractions, and hotel information. But it cannot quite check them in just yet. The robot is based on Neo, a popular $8,000 humanoid robot made by French robotics company Aldebaran, A-L-D-E-B-A-R-A-N, Aldebaran, and the multilingual Neo can be found taking on diverse roles around the world, including as a helpful assistant in Japanese banks. I knew I'd seen him in Japan before. Hilton's version is powered by Watson software, which mostly helps with the natural language processing, so Connie can help understand human speech. Connie also utilizes travel information from Wayblazer, an IBM partner that uses Watson to offer up personalized recommendations for travelers. Watson, which most famously beat human champions in a high-profile Jeopardy competition, is IBM's gateway to bringing AI to the mainstream industries. Outside of the tech industry, he had like wearable, talking, intelligent underwear. We looked at that. Albeit in narrow and specific use cases. Connie, of course, is nothing new. In Japan, you can stay at the Henna Hotel in the Netherlands-themed amusement park that is staffed entirely by robots. We talked about that one before, including the Neobot and a life-sized velociraptor that is used for checking in English patrons.
Some travelers in Japan are preparing for bed in the world's first hotel that is staffed by robots. So it opened up to guests earlier this month. The machines can check you in. They can carry your luggage. They can even offer travel suggestions. Seth Doan got a sneak peek. He's in Tokyo, where the robots are becoming the norm. Seth, good morning.
Good morning. Meet Pepper for about $1,600. It won't do your chores, but it will read your emotions, even communicate, a sort of robot companion. We've seen a lot of robots here in Japan, and we're among the first guests at a truly futuristic hotel near the city of Nagasaki.
The opening of a small, low-cost hotel doesn't usually warrant international attention. Even with gimmicks like drones or the boss arriving via robotic platform. But the Henna Hotel, which translates to strange hotel in Japanese, lives up to its name. Just meet the front desk staff.
Please ask me a request, but don't ask me a difficult question because I am a robot.
Yes, that's an English-speaking dinosaur robot designed to appeal to kids. Also at reception, an almost creepy humanoid programmed to speak Japanese and bow. There's a robotic bag check, even a robot concierge.
What do you want to know? Check in, check out, breakfast?
Breakfast.
Breakfast is a buffet style. It opens from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Hideo Sawada is the man in charge. We asked if robots could really replace, say, a concierge who has actually tasted food.
Isn't hospitality about connecting with people? Isn't that an important part of the hotel business?
For five-star hotels that are selling high-end service, human staff are essential, he told us. But for three- or four-star hotels, you need comfortable lodging and a basic level of communication at a reasonable price. Sawada says having robots fill jobs can help reduce labor costs by about 70%. Here, rooms start at roughly $80 a night.
You talk about this being a low-cost hotel, but having this sort of investment in these robots seems quite expensive.
Yes, robots don't come cheap, he acknowledged, but compared to a year's worth of personnel costs, they are quite cost-effective. And as technology improves, I think they'll become quite price competitive. In technology-crazed Japan, robots are becoming a part of everyday life. From commercials to appearances on TV as modern-day samurai. They're in stores greeting customers. Or as we saw, titillating tourists at Tokyo's robot restaurant. So really, why not in hotels too? After the crowds let up, I checked in.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Henna Hotel.
Thank you.
Do you wish to use facial recognition for entrance?
There were some software hiccups, but eventually I was off.
Enjoy your comfortable stay.
To test the robot Porter.
I could probably carry this on my own, but why not try another robot?
Punch in a room number and it will take you there, albeit slowly.
You wouldn't want to be in a rush to your room.
Here, facial recognition, in theory, replaces a room key.
Reject.
But it took a few tries.
Didn't need a room key.
I got in, only to find another robot.
This robot is speaking Japanese and it's a little confusing.
Thankfully, there was a cheat sheet to help with the wording, but it couldn't do much for my pronunciation.
Akari kashite.
What was truly astounding, it deciphered my Japanese and turned out the lights.
The lights went off. The camera light's on, but the room lights are off. Great, she understands my Japanese. I slept well, but ultimately needed a human to help with the checkout because there were computer problems. This hotel is a pilot project. The idea is to work out the kinks and then expand first in Japan and ultimately overseas. But Nora, if you know someone who works in a hotel, I wouldn't worry that their job is in jeopardy just yet.
Around the globe, robots are popping up in a number of work environments to take over or augment human activities. And Elberdan, and we also heard about Pepper when we listened to the IBM at the Consumer Electronics Show this year. They have partnered with IBM again to give Pepper Watson's artificially intelligent backend. So Hilton is now getting into the concierge automation, and it is not surprising, even though the hotel chain doesn't seem eager to give Connie responsibilities on anywhere near the scale of hotels in more robot-friendly countries. Still, researcher Carl Benedict Fry and Michael Osborne, writing in a 2013 paper titled The Future of Employment, ding, 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 estimates that nearly half of all jobs will be automated over the next 3 to 4 decades. And you notice how always that timeline changes. I've seen 10 years, 20 years, now we're seeing 30 or 40. I think it's going to be sooner rather than later, people. Again, don't let the people panic, so let's just tell them it'll be another 30 years. Hotel concierge, like toll booth operators and fast food cashiers, is high on the list.
Welcome. Welcome to the Hanel Hotel. If you want to check in, please press 1.
Welcome to the Robot Hotel, where robots are at your service. They check guests in, carry bags, and operate locker rooms. It's known locally as the Hen and Na Hotel, which translates from Japanese to the Weird Hotel. It's the brainchild of Hideo Sawada, the CEO of the low-cost travel agent HIS. He said, of course these robots can't just replace all human labor, but in terms of being friendly and polite, they're unbeatable. That's why he asked developers to make robots for this hotel. Other technological innovations in the hotel include facial recognition, allowing guests to access their rooms without a hotel key. Electricity will be partly powered by solar energy aimed at reducing costs. Sawada said the concept is aimed at travelers on a budget, explaining that he thinks low-cost hotels will become a trend, just as low-cost airlines did. Room rates begin at 7,000 yen, around £35 per night, but will be auctioned to the highest bidder during peak season. The company also runs the Hui's Ten Bosch theme park, where the hotel is located.
Dun, 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 dun. But hey, everything will be okay, because we're just going to have this universal income that they're going to give us, pay us to be just useless eaters, not have jobs, and we can sit around and collect our paycheck. Let the robots make all the money, and, you know, the world will be all right. And that's a not. All right, well, I guess we'll end up on this one if I can get its load. We've talked about VR, virtual reality. We looked at a story last week. It was really disturbing. It was some tech conference. I don't even remember which one. There's been so many. Where Zuckerberg, Facebook Zuckerberg, was there. And the entire auditorium was filled with tech geeks with lanyards around their necks and laptops in their lap. and the entire room had geeks with VR goggles on. And as Zuckerberg walked down the aisle, not one person in that entire auditorium saw him because they were sucked totally into the VR machine. And we've discussed before, there have been studies now showing that reality and virtual reality have reached again one of those points in time where it is just about impossible to tell the two apart. Computing power has gotten to the point where we're not craving for more CPU or more memory anymore. We have cloud computing and load balancing and that type of stuff going on. So you could get any of your CPU on demand for your applications if need be and if you can pay for it. So with the advent of VR, and it's going to be launched this year, 2016 is the year. We have a lot of the large organizations like boxing and NASCAR and some of the big concert venues all partnering with cable providers to be able to provide the service online, like a subscription, $29.99 a month. You'll be able to get front side ringside seats for the next big fight or front row for the next from the comfort of your own living room. Well, you know, as we look at over the last couple generations of us being sucked into the machine and that dopamine dangling carrot that addicts us, virtual reality is just that very next step to what then the future is going to be of that cognitive computing, augmented computing, right? They're already doing all these brain implants and Google eyeball things, the Google contact lenses now internet enabled on your eyeball. That, of course, will have direct connect via the optic nerve to your brain. Don't think that this is an accident. This is a very interesting story that came out from Ars Technica a few days ago, March 1st, that caught my attention. Quote, people will fall for it like a drug, unquote, says game devs on the future of VR. Industry luminaries discuss the promise and the pitfalls of impending headsets with Ars Technica. 9 years ago, when the first iPhone was about to debut, not many people envisioned a revolution for good or for ill. And today, as we await the impending release of high-end consumer virtual reality headsets like the likes of Oculus, which of course is owned by Facebook now, Valve, which is the gaming group, and Sony, it feels like we are now at a similar crossroads. Unlike the slow, quiet dawn of smartphone gaming, the hype around VR has been building to a relentless, deafening pitch for years. And remember, gaming has been another whole part of the sucking into the machine back 20 years ago when we saw the first game, the first flight simulator, actually, first-person game skewed at a high-end distributor of computing products. And it was skewed as the seller being Department of Defense. We know that they have been using these to manipulate people since then, at least. And it's really easy, and you can train them, and you can surveil them, and you can find your next whole generation of drone pilots, right? That's kind of what that turned into. So anyway, despite this hype, the industry and those watching it seem relatively split on the eventual impact of VR gaming. It could be a smartphone-level technological change, the biggest the gaming industry has seen in years. Or it could be a quickly irrelevant fad on the order of the Wii or Kinect. The answer to that will be determined with the state of the video game market for years to come. So as many of the industry biggest names gather for the DICE Summit and awards ceremony in late February, I asked everyone I could get my hands on and what they thought of the virtual reality gaming and what it would look like a decade from now. And the range of responses shows just how unsettling and unsettled the fate of the latest virtual reality boom is. Those that have been in the industry long enough to remember the last wave of VR hype back in the mid-90s, and yes, I do remember that. Just like we had tablet computing and a bunch of other things that all went poof. Wasn't time yet. They largely agree something feels different this time around. We wanted snow crash to happen, and then we put on things, and it was just a pterodactyl terror, and we all threw up. And you know what's even funnier? I played that pterodactyl VR game. I was in New York City with an old friend of mine, and we had walked about 4 hours from the village down to Wall Street to the waterfront. And they had that VR pterodactyl game, and it was a big one. It was a console that you would get in and play, and they are absolutely right. It was very kludgy, and it really did not look realistic at all. But it was kind of cool because it was VR, and nothing like that had existed at the time. How weird. I didn't realize that that was the only one. But yeah, that was in the 90s. And perhaps it is telling that he misnamed this less than impressive 90s VR installation dactyl nightmare. But Schaefer is confident in the present. I think there's been a huge leap this time. Yeah, it was down at the Southside Seaport is where it was. I remember when Lawnmower Man came out. It says, or disclosure, freelance game writer Rihanna Pratchett wrote, recalling the pop culture's obsession with virtual worlds at the time, and everyone was saying, oh, this is going to take over, and then it went approximately nowhere. And again, you know, back in those days, we still did not have unlimited computing power, and that was the problem. You know, you still had rendering issues and 3D engines that were still trying to get developed, but we are at that point now where you can have mega memory just on a video card. And then, like I said, we have cloud computing with CPU on demand. So things have definitely changed. Online gaming and interactive gaming is massive. You know, we don't have any of those technological divides anymore. But now for something completely different, the ability to create experiences unlike anything that's possible in traditional gaming on a 2D screen was a recurring theme as I asked attendees about VR's future potential. I was a little skeptical when I first put them on, but I have to say I was really blown away, says Fallout 4's lead producer, Jeff Gardiner. I felt emotions that I think were impossible to reproduce without that medium, and a real sense of fear, a sense of wonder. And you know, I was reading another story not too long ago about them now in the future using these VR goggles to do news reporting, where they will have drones, let's say, at a site that they want to report on, and the reporter can put the goggles on and report as if they were on the scene. And there's all kinds of questions about the ethics of that. If anyone remembers back on CNN, I don't remember, was it Libya or the Gulf War or something like that, where they busted them using a blue screen? I don't know if it was Wolf Blitzer or one of those guys. They busted them for using a blue screen or a green screen. Maybe it was even Geraldo Rivera pretending like they were at the scene and they really weren't. But what are the ethics now of having reporters using drones to be on the scene and reporting? I mean, I guess it would be safer than being in like a live fire zone. But on the other hand, you know, what kind of a future is this? And one of the big things that I've read too about VR is that it sucks you so into the machine that you actually start to feel the emotions and can even experience the PTSD in a war zone that maybe the same PTSD that the soldiers that are in the middle of that war zone would be feeling. You know, they could just equip the soldiers with HD goggles on their new bio suits and or HD cameras, I mean, on their new bio suits that then you could tap into. You know, look at it on a map and go, oh, look, you know, number one over there is right at the front line. Let's tap into his camera and see what is going on there. Says, I think there is so much potential for great storytelling and so much potential everywhere, but being able to put the players into a relaxing environment, there are health benefits to that alone. Well, bullshit, I would not get these things on my head. To those who may think VR hype is being pushed by clueless moneyed investors trying to force demands for an unwanted product, Supergiant Games' Amir Rayo says that the interest on the development side is very real. And like I said, this is just talking about gamers, but this is going to go way beyond gamers in 2016. Cable companies have jumped right on board, and you wait and see. There's going to be lots of stuff coming. The initial high cost of VR headsets was also a concern for some of the industry. I think that we are right now around $1,500. And that's a big price point, but it's going to be the early adopters that really have a push. And don't worry about it, because those prices will come down very quickly. That's how it works. By Christmas, we are probably going to see them down, so you can get one in your stocking. And even assuming that the price point eventually comes down, getting virtual reality in front of people is going to be a difficult but important first step to the market. Right. Not all adults play video gaming, but many adults watch television, and that's going to be their entry point. Right now, early adopters for VR are highly enthusiastic, and they're going to drive a lot in the market. And hey, that NASCAR is going to get all those NASCAR people, and there's millions of them, on board. Who wouldn't want to have a front row seat and be able to eat popcorn on their own couch instead of having to deal with all that hoo-ha and all those people and trying to get in and out? So anyway, I don't know what you think about this. It was kind of a lame-assed ending, but whatever. The title caught me. The future of VR, it's going to be like a drug and people will fall for it.
Inside story of Oculus Rift and how virtual reality became reality. It appears in the June issue of Wired magazine and is available at wired.com. Peter, welcome.
Thank
you. How would you describe the appearance of the experience of virtual reality?
Well, the word that Oculus uses and a lot of people are using now is this concept of presence. In the past, you would put goggles on, whoever made them, and there would be screens in front of your face. And there was an illusion there, but not much more than that. Now, you really are enveloped in this world, whatever that world is. Maybe it's a video game, maybe you're in a movie theater watching a movie on an IMAX.
Well, Big Ad sort of talked in the piece a little bit about the alternate uses of this, but it was so interesting to see Zuckerberg post something saying, this is how we could see doctors, this is how we could go to school in another country and learn about something from a real foreign teacher.
I mean, for him, this is the platform on which everybody's going to be communicating.
Yeah.
It's not about having Facebook in virtual reality. It's about being there to help guide this new platform that is going to become the default. I mean, we're very used to screens now and smartphone screens being the window through which we mediate the world. That's going to change now that we have something that's so much more immediate and present for ourselves.
Right. What always strikes me when I see something like this, given the pace of change now, is if we're here now, where are we going to be in 5 or 10 years?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, and they're very quick to say, everybody who works with Oculus, and even Mark Bowles is quick to say that we're at the infancy of this new technology. Not in the infancy in the sense that it just began, because people have been trying to crack this problem for 30 years. It's now that we've made this a consumer product, what's next?
But make sure you stick around because it is Thursday. Mr. Kevin Blanch is live up next. 7 o'clock. 8 o'clock. Guy in the Woodshed. Jason Nelson's at 10. And there's some kids at 11. All right, guys. Have an awesome Thursday. I'll get you.